Hello, pals. It's me, and this is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you run into super cool people. This happens only if you go to super weird places, usually, and this is how I was lucky enough to meet today's guest, Neil Allen. By the way, I don't mean weird in the pejorative. I mean weird as in cool, awesome, outside the beaten path that you've been going on in some terrible infinite circuit, which I've been going on before I started spending time at these Ram Dass retreats. And I've met a lot of awesome people there. I got to meet Neil because I met his wife, Annie Lamott, and did a podcast with her, and he was there, and we talked a little bit, and over time, by some act of grace or good fortune from the universe, I became friends with Annie and Neil, and we started talking more. He wrote a book called Shapes of Truth, which is wonderful. I was very interested in this book, not just because I like Neil and because the book, the premise of the book is incredibly trippy, but because Neil and my mom both spent time in something called a mystery school, this thing called Diamond Heart. I'm not going to try to talk about it because I don't really understand it. If you're someone who watched the Midnight Gospel and watched the episode with my mom, then a lot of the things she was telling me come from this Diamond Heart approach, as it's called. And because it was my mom, I intentionally avoided it as much as possible. But after she passed away, I've become more interested in it. And so I spent some time, some non-podcast time with Neil, where he was showing me some facets of this mystery school. And it was some of the most intense, mind-expanding hours that I've had in my life. There's this interesting thing that I began to notice when I was hanging out with the Ram Dass people before COVID and going to the retreats and spending time with them, which is that the people who had been in the direct presence of Neem Karoli Baba, and honestly, many people who hadn't, but who had had some experience of this being's presence, they all had a kind of sweetness to them, like an energetic sweetness that was identical. And the more I began to see it in people, the more I realized that what I was looking at was some kind of metaphysical fingerprint or something. I guess it's not really that weird. I mean, if you meet people who all share the same shitty, monstrous boss, you might notice that they have a kind of commonality in their negativity, a sort of similar limp to their gait from being abused by some rotten manager or something like that. And so if that happens at a Best Buy, then it's probably going to happen in the reverse in other ways too. It's like these people exist in the world who are, I don't know, like they're flowery. They leave a sweetness on people who get to come into contact with them. And it's really trippy talking to Neil, today's guest, because there's something about him that reminds me of my mom. And I think what that thing is the shared experience they've had with the Diamond Heart approach and with this mysterious being called Almas, who I still don't know a lot about, which, by the way, is something I love about Neil's book, Shapes of Truth. I've never read anything like it before. I've never heard of anything like this, and it's somehow connected to a mystery school, which makes it really enticing for me. But more than that, having worked with Neil a little bit and experienced some of what he writes about in this book, I can verify that it's really powerful. And I hope you will check out his book. You can go to shapesoftruth.com, find everything you need to know about that book. You definitely should order it. As you're about to see, he's a genius and a wonderful, funny, brilliant person. We're going to jump right into this episode after this. Much thanks to ExpressVPN for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. I know none of my listeners watch pornography. It's really interesting. I would think at least a few of you do because I watch it all the time. But just in case you know people that do, you want to pay attention to this. With everything going on in the world, governments have increased their surveillance. They're using your devices to track your locations, movements, and in many countries, your internet activity. You don't want to be caught with your beautiful pants down. And one of the best ways to keep your online browsing activity private is by using ExpressVPN. When you use ExpressVPN, your internet connection is rerouted through a secure encrypted server so you can surf the web anonymously without anyone looking over your shoulder. Look, I know you probably think that all you have to do is use incognito mode and no one can see that you've watched whatever you're into. But sadly, you're wrong. Even when you use incognito mode, your internet provider like Comcast or AT&T can see every single website you visit. And if you live on campus or use a shared Wi-Fi, so can your network admin. It's just too much. You don't want them to know that. I don't need everyone at the Holiday Inn to know how I like watching lesbians suck each other's feet. That's why I use ExpressVPN whenever I go online, and I recommend all of you do the same. Without ExpressVPN, you're giving people a free license to peek over your shoulder and see all the amazing, freaky shit you're looking at. If you're into that, great, but if that makes you feel a little nervous, you should give them a shot. Protect your privacy today and get 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Visit expressvpn.com/Duncan. That's ExpressVPN.com/Duncan for 3 months free with a 1 year package. Visit expressvpn.com/Duncan to learn more. And we are back. Would you like commercial free episodes of the DTFH untainted by capitalism? Would you like direct access to one of the most brilliant, powerful, erotic, glorious communities that ever existed online? Would you like to join our weekly meditation group, Journey into Boredom, or hang out with us every Friday at our family gatherings? If so, I want to invite you to join our Patreon. It's at patreon.com/DTFH. I got to say this now. I know I've been saying it every episode, but I'm getting like intense pressure from my many attorneys that I have to read this off the page. We must reiterate, we have nothing to do with the small to mid-sized animal attacks that have been happening across the planet. We aren't saying that we aren't causing or are causing them. We're not saying that they have anything to do with subscribing to the Patreon or not subscribing to the Patreon. And we cannot say why people who have subscribed to the Patreon are no longer being attacked by these animals. Head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. And now, everyone, please welcome to the DTFH the author of Shapes of Truth, Neil Allen. Neil, welcome back to the DTFH. I gotta tell you, there's something that we've talked about. We've talked about by now a lot of cool things. One of the reasons we've talked about a lot of cool things is because we already did an episode of the DTFH, which I lost due to a technical error. Of all the things that we've talked about, the one that really I find the most unnerving and kind of mind-blowing is your attitude when it comes to cancellations and like things not happening according to the expected schedule. And I wonder if we could just start off with you talking a little bit about that philosophy and what it is.
I guess the way I think about it is things don't go wrong quite the way we think they do. We think that things go wrong because they don't meet our expectations of how things are supposed to go, right? So we think that we're very accurate at predicting the future, and when it doesn't happen that way, we blame ourselves or blame other people. The problem with that viewpoint is that, in fact, nothing goes wrong. We think things should happen a certain way. The only way things should happen is the way they do happen.
Right.
And that's called acceptance or letting go, or, you know, there are a lot of kind of new age ways of, doing this magic thing where you can accept fate where it takes you. For most of us, that's kind of a crock of shit. You can't accept things going wrong. They went wrong, and I've got to prevent them from going wrong in the future. And thinking any other way is going to get me into a lot of trouble, right?
Yes. Yes.
And I'm not going to get what I want, and people aren't going to like me, and I'm going to end up homeless and with my body rotting on a sidewalk somewhere, right?
Yep.
And so everybody thinks that way. The problem with having a viewpoint of acceptance is it only works if instead of it being an intellectual viewpoint, you actually try it out, right? And so you actually have to see what would happen if instead of complaining a lot about things not happening the way they should, I instead went out and pretended that I wasn't much of an actor in the world, that I had very little effect on the world. And just pretending this, right? I don't have to, I can just wear this for an hour or a minute or a day or preferably about a week and see what happens if I have no strong expectations about what's going to happen next. The curious thing is that if I let the world just kind of drag me along and I don't pay much attention to my influence on the world, I get the same amount of stuff done. In fact, the world actually drags me along in exactly the same way that I think that I am influencing my life. It's just that I have this weird app that tells me things are going wrong or things are going right, and I think I'm making things go wrong or things go right or whatever, but I'm really just being dragged along. I'm disrupting my background metaphysics, essentially, and saying, wait a minute, maybe I can live in a metaphysics that doesn't require me to spend so much energy on free will, and maybe the world will evolve the exact same way. The Buddhists call this dependent arising, I think, and it's a way of situating myself in the world without a lot of preconceptions. And if I don't have a lot of preconceptions, I can't think things go wrong.
And how does that? Oh, yeah, sorry, please.
One more thing, this is my discovery, and I'm taking full credit for it. And if anybody ever mentions it to anybody else, I want them to give me credit for it, because I deserve credit. Most everything that I say, I've stolen, but this one I thought up on my own.
You got to come up with a name up for it, then. I mean, we need a name for the philosophy.
All right, we'll do it afterward because it's actually not a philosophy. This is a discovery of human behavior that most people have not ever heard of. Nobody's heard of, because I discovered it. When I was a kid, my favorite chore was wiping down the woodwork. I loved it's just aesthetically pleasing to get all that grime around a doorknob, and all it takes, you really can do it mostly with warm water. You can put 409 on your rag or whatever, but most of it just kind of wipes clear, and you all of a sudden have a fresh doorknob. The other day, a few weeks and maybe a few months ago, I was looking at the doorknob and thinking about that. And all of a sudden I realized that all that grime, and Annie and I, we have our own bathroom. Nobody else goes into this bathroom, it's, you know, pretty much ever. Yeah. And so any grime on that door handle on the inside of that bathroom door is Annie's and mine, right?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it. Where'd that grime come from? You know where it came from? We're not very good at, as people, at getting it right how to open a door, right?
Yeah.
Every bit of that grime was, I missed, and I hit the woodwork with my finger. The efficient way to open a door would be to get my hand around the knob and open it, right?
Yeah, right.
I don't do that.
Yeah.
I put my hand, my grimy fingers above it, below it, next to it. I'm missing it. You know, not every time, but presumably a high enough percentage of the time that I'm a failure as a door opener. Right?
Yeah, right.
Who would think that I am, that's going wrong multiple times a day, and it's just not even registering to me that, no, my predictive abilities, my ability to encounter the world and know what to expect is really much worse than I think. And in many ways, I live with it, right? I live with it by wiping down the woodwork every once in a while. But in other ways, I think, no, this is something I need to control. Well, maybe I don't.
Why do you think this discovery sounds so blasphemous to people like me? I mean, I've heard, I don't know how many hours of this podcast I have done, and I've heard many controversial viewpoints, but this one I find somehow to be the most. I've interviewed Satanists, but I've never heard anything so blasphemous as this idea. I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek here, but this idea is, it really upsets me. Like, anytime you've forgiven me for flaking out or for losing this podcast, which I was excited to release, it was in my calendar when to release it, and I was just assuming I had it. But in my expectation, whenever I contact someone like you, I know must be busy, and say, you know, that hour plus you gave to me way back when, that I told you I'd release at this time, it's gone. It's just the fantasies of how you and Annie would treat me after this. My first thought was, they'll never talk to me again. So there goes some friends. There's some friends down the tubes because you fucked up. You're supposed to be a professional podcaster. What? You can't figure out how to record audio, like the basic fundamental quality of this. And so my assumption was, well, there you go. Another friendship lost to your disorganization. And so to be met with a response such as what you just said is, I don't know why, but somehow it really burns. Can you explain why?
Well, it's hard to, first of all, that was my public response. Our private response was, huh, we thought Duncan was a pothead, but maybe it's heroin.
I wish. Oh, I wish. If I was on heroin, you can blame it on the heroin. What do I blame it on?
It went this far, which was, let's see, he had cancer, so he probably did heavy painkillers for a while. Maybe he sucked on morphine.
Is that true? That's the conversation you had?
Well, that's how we talk. So we talk that way about everybody all the time.
No,
but we have zero belief that we're accurate.
Oh, so let me tell you something. I'm so glad you're being honest about that, because that is more the conversation I figured y'all were having. Because it's like, well, they definitely, you know, Annie's in recovery, so this kind of stuff is going to make her think that I just must be on some insane amount of weird drugs. Because otherwise, how do you fuck up this bad? But yeah, sadly, I can't even really blame it on the weed. Okay. Thank you for being honest about that. And also thanks for not saying that as your first response, because then maybe I would have just gotten into heroin or something.
Well, I mean, the fact is that response was was, I'll be sincere now, and that response was our having fun, right? Because sure. we expect everything in our lives to screw up. We just yeah. do. And Annie's a good friend of a guy named David Roach, and he's, I think he titles himself the priest or pastor of the Church of 80%. And his yeah. line is, you can be 80% all right with just about anything, but make sure that you preserve the right for things to be 20% off.
And yeah.
My favorite line of his is that he says, for instance, darling, instead of saying, I love you forever, he says, darling, I promise I love you. I love you till the end of dinner.
sometimes that's a pretty big promise.
That is. That's a big promise. Why would we promise more? Why wouldn't we accept the fact that even our most beloved people are going to be annoying and are going to insult us and irritate us and annoy us? And that's okay, because we're not supposed to be 100% at anything, right?
No.
Including everyday life. But I think what's really annoying about it is we want to have free will. We want to have control. And we want to believe that we deserve accolades for the hard work of living. And
yes.
there's no question that life is absurdly difficult, right? As a humorist, you know full well that every single joke you tell is mocking the difficulty of being a human being. The absurd difficulty of life gives us all irony, all sarcasm, all humor. Maybe there are bits of humor that don't do that. Little kids joking around don't know how hard life is yet. But most sophisticated humor it's just hard. The hard part is we're expected to be productive. And we're expected to get things done, and we're expected to be rewarded with external value, with being liked or getting money or being famous or being powerful, whatever. And for me to say, I got to take life as it comes, I'm giving away my right to have control over life. And that's scary as hell.
Yeah.
Because I've got a little voice in me that says, if I don't keep taking control of life, I'm going to end up homeless and on the sidewalk.
Yep. Yeah, this is it. That impulse to take control of everything tortures me. And especially when it has to do with taking control of like things in the past, which because it doesn't seem to be able to distinguish the present from the past, from the future. It just wants an all-encompassing control over all aspects of reality when it's really bad. But any time that I've allowed myself the fantasy, like you're saying, right now I'm going to call it a fantasy, I'm not sure, but anytime I've allowed myself that fantasy and really pulled it off like a Meisner acting style where I really do it versus, like you're saying, intellectualize it, the relief is so tremendous. So immense. There's such a sense of peace, and then I am able to connect with people over dinner or connect with people because I'm not completely broiling over with a sense of like, well, I must have, where did I fuck up, you know, or even everything was a fuck up. I don't know where I went right here. Is this similar to Ram Dass's idea, Neem Karoli Baba's idea, everything's perfect? You know, the famous story, Ram Dass, when will you see everything's perfect?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I thought you were going to say, is this similar to them saying be here now? And they are the same thing. Be here now. Everything's perfect. Let go. Allow the world to organize itself on its own. One way of thinking about it is that we're taught that we can't escape from time and we can't escape from space. And so we invent a God who's omniscient and is able to do those things. We leave out a third thing we can't escape from. And that is the world will organize itself without my input.
Right.
And it will always organize itself. And in fact, the only people it doesn't organize itself for are people with disorganized minds, right? Who have a mental illness or who for some reason or another have an organic problem where their minds are disorganized. But for everybody else, most of us, from moment to moment to moment to moment, the world is perfectly organized around us and perfectly supportive of where we are. If the world wasn't supportive of us, we wouldn't be alive still, right? So,
right.
You know, if you're alive and you're however old you are, which means you're your own age, then the world has been supportive, right? And
right.
That doesn't mean that bad things don't happen. That doesn't mean there aren't natural disasters. That doesn't mean people don't die early. That doesn't mean we don't have wars. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't work for justice systems that help people who are in danger. That doesn't mean that we act as if, it's the best of all possible worlds and become a bunch of Candides and Pollyannas running around with little blissful grins on our faces.
Right.
It's not like that. It's that at the same time that I have free will and an ability to vote and an ability to talk to you right now and an ability to influence people and an ability to beat up my enemy if that's what I want to do, I also have going on at the exact same time a perfect world that is always organizing itself perfectly. And it's weird, but I can hold both thoughts at the same time. So as Westerners, we're taught to look at free will and determinism, or the kind of God world that everything's determined for you, free will and determinism, as opposites, and they can't coexist.
Right.
If you're brought up in child in India, you're more likely to be taught there is free will and at the same time there is determinism.
Right.
And they coexist, and sometimes you're better off being in free will, you know, and get it when you're voting, and other times you're better off being in a deterministic world when you're being carried along by the flow.
Yeah, I've heard this described as relative and absolute reality.
Relative and absolute reality. And there are, you know, people talk about non-dualism, they mean several different things. There are sort of four different metaphysical systems I know of that call themselves non-dualism, but all of them involve some way to merge those two views. Right. So they're always talking about what in philosophy is called a materialist and an empiricist. That's how I was brought up. Right. I think a table is a table and it's got the essence of table in it. There's an ideal table out there, but it's solid and I can put my fist on it and I know what a table is. And I'm an empiricist. I go around and I see things out there and I judge the world according to individual things I see out there. That's a very particular way, very particular metaphysics that's grounded in us universally.
Yes.
So all these Eastern systems are doing is, and Western philosophy does this too in a little more tragically subtle and piecemeal way, but the Eastern systems go and say, well, let's disrupt your materialism, your empiricism. Let's give you some other metaphysical views. And by doing that, they're not saying these are better metaphysical views. That's what happens. That's the mistake people find when they go into, I want to live as a hermit in absorption, right?
Yes.
That's better. No, that's another metaphysical view that you're going to attach to. The great thing about learning and having your materialist empiricism disrupted is that it lightens it up.
Right.
By knowing that I could be a materialist empiricist or I could be something else metaphysical, I get to not take being a materialist empiricist so seriously.
Right.
And so my familiar life can go on, but it doesn't take itself quite as seriously because I realize, well, there's other ways I could look at this. And the chief other way to look at it, the one that most of these systems hang on to at some point, is I'm materialist empiricist and I'm being dragged along by an interdependent world that I can't find cause and effect in anywhere that would allow me free will because everything is so interlocked together.
Right.
And it's a wonderful feeling to be able to notice that all I'm doing with free will is selecting out some fairly trivial variables and working with them, while around that, surrounding it, is this wonderfully independent, dependent, arising universe that I have no control over and that has already put me in the exact right spot for me to be in and will take me to the exact right spot tomorrow.
This reminds me of Tim Leary's advice that I read a very long time ago, and I can't remember what book it was in, which was lift up your legs and float downstream. That's it. That is actually quite good advice. If you've ever been, I bet you do. Have you ever gone rafting on a river?
Oh yeah.
You ever capsized in a river? And the first thing they tell you is don't fucking try to stand up. It's a river. What are you doing? If you try to stand up, you're screwed. Your foot's going to get stuck under a rock. Who knows? You try to float down because you can't beat a river a lot of the times. But when you fall out of the boat, that's like the first thing you're going to want to do. It's just built in, is to try to stand up, try to control it. I love the philosophy. I love lightening up that part of me. It feels like so subtly revolutionary. I want to thank Upstart for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. Upstart, it's the fast and easy way to pay off your debt with a personal loan all online. Are you in that place where you don't want to look at your credit card statements every month because when you do, it freezes your heart and makes you wonder if perhaps you actually are living in hell? Upstart can lift that weight off your shoulders so that you can finally feel the relief of being free of credit card debt. Whether it's paying off credit cards, consolidating high interest debt, or funding personal expenses, over 500,000 people have used Upstart to get a simple, fixed monthly payment. Unlike other lenders, Upstart looks at more than your credit score, like your income and employment history. This means they can offer smarter rates with trusted partners. If only I had this a decade ago when my credit score was the same as my IQ, 180. With a 5-minute online rate check, you could see your rate up front for loans between $1,000 to $50,000. You can receive funds as fast as one business day after accepting your loan. Find out how Upstart can lower your monthly payments today when you go to upstart.com/Duncan. That's upstart.com/Duncan. Don't forget to use our URL to let them know we sent you. Loan amounts will be determined based on your credit, income, and certain other information provided in your loan application. Go to upstart.com/Duncan. You know, it feels like what you're talking about, which is a wonderful articulation of a lot of different lineages. How does it work? How does this work in the big picture? And maybe that's a dumb question because we're not supposed to worry about that. We should just worry about ourselves. But I'm thinking I'm trying to run a business or something. You know, I don't know what it is. Or let's say I'm running a hospital and one of my doctors doesn't show up for an operation. This is not forgivable. I'm not going to be able to be like, well, you know, everything happens. There's a bigger picture here. It's like, you know, someone died because you didn't show up for this job. Or sometimes I'll, you know, God, I don't know why Aaron and I have been doing this, but we just watch Dateline all the time now. Maybe it's the pandemic, to like resonate with the horror of the pandemic. Just story after story of murder. And at some point watching this, I realized how amazing it is that these detectives take their job so seriously. Like how lucky in society that there's people who are fully, seemingly dedicated to enforcing the law and getting justice for people who've been murdered, that they aren't just like, whatever. I mean, are we really going to, like, everyone dies eventually. So how do we reckon with the reality? We do need an almost mechanistic way of running society, and that doesn't seem to fit in very well with lifting up your legs and floating downstream, or not everyone can do that, at least.
I think that, so I vote, I do socially relevant things, I am appropriate in public, I drive a car, I stop at red lights. There are social restraints that are built into my species of human beings. They're not moral. We're taught that they're moral, but what they are, I mean, they're moral if you accept the fact that morality is whatever is convenient for the species to expand and fill new niches. And so that's right. What we do as human beings. We're probably the second best species at it after bacteria, right? They can go, they can fill it niches yeah. that we can't even imagine filling underwater yeah. and
in the cracks of the earth.
The top of Everest and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But we're pretty good at it. And that's what we call morality, is protecting the species' right, self-taught right to expand its numbers. I participate in that. And I have either a responsibility or maybe just a light social engagement that allows me to participate in that as part of my life. I have a huge part of my life that doesn't have to do that. That's called right. my individuality. Okay. When I'm dealing with public health authorities, I should have no individuality. They call it public health because it has to be public, and it has to be statistical, and it has to be not based on my belief in science, but on real science, right?
Right. Right.
But I have this other part of me that's private and that's individual, and that is creative and is interested and fascinated by the world as it is and is apart from the social structures. So this me takes walks in the woods, this me wool gathers, and this me can do all sorts of things. It can get into a kayak and float down a river, right? Yeah. And that me is non-productive unless it wants to be productive, and its productivity can be for its own sake and not for a social sake, right? Now, yeah. my productive side, which has this control mechanism called a superego, a little voice in my head that keeps me productive and keeps me stuck in the social moralistic side of expanding the species and filling more niches, that yeah. side of me doesn't want me to have an individual self. That side of me wants me to be spending all its time focused on the rules and the restraints and
yeah.
being productive in my, what it really wants me to do is be a mid-level manager in a big corporation, have a suburban house, two kids, a dog, and two nice cars, right? That's yep. what it wants. That is the American dream for Americans and for immigrants and for refugees and for anybody. It's the exact same.
Right.
And what's interesting about that is that it is a modest enterprise that has financial, economic, social, political moderation to it, that if everybody's aspiring to that, it's a pretty good balance for being able to spread the species and for the species to succeed.
Right.
There isn't anything all that much better about a brick suburban house than a tin shack, right? And, you know, if you think about it, they're mostly shelter, right?
And right.
most of us get our needs done very simply, but we end up doing this social dance and improving our level of whatever, income or whatever. That doesn't mean that to focus on myself and to notice that I have self-worth built in that doesn't need to be productive, that doesn't need external validation and doesn't need to be part of the financial system all the time. That self is allowed to run free at times. And the more that that self runs free, the more it can sort of see through the game of the species right. expanding itself and how it kind of pulls me along into this very conservative world of a socially defined being. That's one way to answer, is that I have a social life and I have an individual life. And my individual life can involve people or not. My social life always involves people. And my social life, I just want to make sure that that productive social life doesn't take up all my time. I want other time elsewhere. The more I do that, the more I find that this other self that is okay with how things are, this individual self, the more I can bring it into my social life and it lightens up my social life.
Okay.
To the point where when I think about the extreme example, here's the extreme example, right? The extreme example is it's World War II and I'm in the bunker and there's Hitler standing and we're eye to eye, right?
Yeah.
And I'm looking at him.
It sounds like you're in the wrong bunker. What are you doing in Hitler's bunker? What's going on? Why are you in that bunker?
Keep in mind.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
So I'm looking him in the eyes and I'm thinking to myself, he didn't ask to be Hitler, right? He got brought up a certain way that made him Hitler, right? There isn't anything wrong with him being Hitler in that sense that he didn't decide this for him. Lots and lots and lots of influences he had no control over brought him to this moment, like me, right? I didn't ask to be the guy in the bunker with Hitler. Lots and lots of things brought me there. And eventually I can get to empathy with Hitler, right? And I can say, I am capable of being him. He's capable of being me. I am him, right? That's what empathy is. It's ultimately coming to the fact that we're, you know, it's like Kurt Vonnegut, nice, nice, very nice, so many people in the same device, right?
Yeah.
That's it. We're in the same device. Wow. That's humans. And we are the same kind of people. And we didn't ask for the life that we got, but some of us feel lucky. Some of us feel unlucky. Even that's not quite the way it is. But at any rate, I look him in the eyes. I am you. He is me. Full compassion. And the right thing to do is I pull out my 45 and I shoot him between the eyes because he's Hitler, right?
Yes. You got to shoot Hitler. But you can shoot Hitler compassionately.
But I know I'm shooting myself too. You know,
right.
I know that.
Right, that's justice.
So there's a time and a place for justice and for voting and for trying to raise people. You know, equalize the opportunities for people, and those are very, very important. You know, my wife and I engage with politics, but we also spend a lot of time not engaged with politics.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, this is I'm curious about how you and Annie have fused together, because anyone who's read any of her books knows that she is a basically some kind of Christian mystic or something. And a lot of what you're saying, like Meister Eckhart level, but for the modern era, like articulating all the deep metaphysics of Christianity, but in a way that we can digest, but in a way you when you leave it, her books, you don't know what to call yourself, except you're just like, oh, I guess I am a Christian, and I guess I do love Jesus. But you in your book Shapes of Truth, it seems like this is a different lineage than Christianity. This is Sufism, and hearing you talk, it just makes me wonder, how does it work? What metaphysically with you two? Are there places where you're at odds with her mystically? And I don't mean to stir up anything, by the way. I'm kind of, I feel a little clumsy with that question. Okay.
We love this question. Annie and I both love this question because every time we're asked it, we get to think about this remarkable luck we had in finding each other. Because one of the underpinnings of our falling in love and our relationship was exactly this question: how do two people with very strong spiritual bents and kind of sort of belief systems not just cooperate, in as Annie puts it, not looking for, you know, inviting our Jewish friends to Christmas dinner, right? It's
right.
Not like that. It's that her spirituality has zero to do with with Christianity, with the church, right? Her spirituality has to do with what she learns from having a personal relationship with Jesus. She could care less about what the church says is Christian dogma or what she's supposed to believe, right? But she picks up on certain attitudes that Jesus has about suffering that are remarkable and just bent as shit, right? They are really bent ideas, right? And the bent ideas are the ones that take you into the radical bent ideas are the ones that take you into further possibilities so that I can expand myself out of this very limited materialist empiricism that I was brought up in.
What are the bent ideas? Can you name a few?
Yeah, I'm long-winded. I'll get there.
Okay,
she's got
you.
Some bent ideas. I've got my own bent ideas, like in this book, right? And they're just kind of, people who read them may or may not take to them, but their primary intent is to disrupt you from your typical way of looking at things. It doesn't matter to me how I'm disrupting you. I want to disrupt you.
Yes.
I want you to think that you can tear yourself away from the little voice that tells you to keep yourself restrained and open yourself up and spend some part of your day in that more open place. And that more open place has a name, which is soul. And whether it's whether you're a Christian or a Buddhist or Vedantic or Vedic or Sufi, you're going to have a word like soul, right?
Yeah.
And it's basically, who am I before the outside world gets to me, right? Who am I when I have internal worth and I haven't even done anything yet, right?
Yeah.
I'm just a blob. I mean, who would ever say that a one-month-old baby didn't have value, right?
Right.
And that one-month-old baby can't even objectify the world yet. It has no idea that there are things, right?
Right.
Can't build value, can't engage in transactions. Even in her mind, she can't, right?
Yeah.
And yet we know she has value, right? So we all know what a soul is. A soul's right there. That one-month infant. That's the soul, right there.
Yeah.
You can point to it, and you can see the kind of wiggly way of absorbing itself into the world around it that the infant does. The infant's free in a strange way, since it's so dependent. But maybe we're all dependent that way as adults, and we forget that, right? And we're wiggling just like babies. So she's got her kind of Jesus world, and I've got my whatever. I don't have a lineage, but I picked up things here and there, and particularly this guy, Hamid Ali, who has a mystery school in Berkeley called Diamond Heart that your mother was in.
Yes.
And so I have my lineage that takes me to that soul. Annie has her lineage that takes her to that soul. That soul looks exactly the same. So what we noticed was, and we're both writers, and so I'll be writing about something that takes me toward the soul and some aspect of the soul. And I'll walk in and I'll say, hey, you know, I'm writing about the discriminatory power of the soul. And she'll say, what are you talking about? and I'll say, well, you know how you've got a soul, kind of, and you don't really know what it is, and yet somehow it can kind of parse the world and pick things out. And she'll go, oh, oh, you mean this. And then she'll start talking about that and I'll take notes or whatever. And it'll kind of amplify where I was at that moment trying to figure something out. So we'll kind of amplify each other. By the way, we get totally buzzed when this is happening, right? When you're talking about the soul goes, hey, this is cool. Talk about me. Talk about me. And it's like we're tripping all of a sudden, right?
Yeah.
And we're talking about the soul. So there's that fun aspect to it. There's also, because I'm around a Christian, I get to spend time, more time than I would, thinking particularly about Jesus's lessons or parables or whatever, because they're kind of in the air. She's writing about them, or I'm hearing her talk to somebody about them or whatever. And so it gets me thinking about them. He is the compassion guy, right? So he's the forgiveness and compassion guy, right? Just like Buddha is the disrupt your metaphysics guy. And Krishnamurti is don't trust institutions guy, and give up your identities guy. And all these, Adyashanti is awakened to being awakened. He's that guy, right?
Yeah.
Well, Jesus is the compassion guy. Compassion guy has a huge amount of force and importance in an organized, particularly industrialized civilization, any organized civilization, because the problem with civilization is, unlike tribal life, you live next door to strangers. And that's what Jesus is about. He's about, question whether you should be suspicious of that guy. Question whether you should separate people into friends and enemies. And he's radical about it. And he's an important guy to listen to. Jesus is so amazing. He comes out of nowhere. And one of the first things that he does is he gives a lecture on what he knows, right?
Yeah.
And it's called the Sermon on the Mount. And the first line of the Sermon on the Mount is, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah.
He comes out of the box and yells to people, hey, you got it upside down. The losers, the poor in spirit, the people who no longer believe in wealth or fame or anything that they've been taught, the complete losers, they're usually poor also, besides being poor in spirit.
Yeah.
I've been walking around the world, and those are the coolest people around. He's not saying, go feed the poor. He's going and saying, why don't you emulate the poor in spirit? Why don't you get right down into the bottom of the dark night of the soul where you have no hope that anything out there is going to help you be better or feel better or help get rid of this little strange feeling of not quite belonging in this world or feeling depressed or whatever. Go all the way down there, become a big loser, and guess what? The kingdom of heaven is yours now.
Wow.
Because there's a little portal there, right? Some people, I just heard a great, it might be a trap door at the bottom of the dark night of the soul. At the bottom of the well, you think you're on the floor and there's a trap door and you fall through and there's God, right?
Wow.
Or you go, or it takes you to a wormhole. There are different metaphors for how the dark night of the soul works. But Jesus is saying, do that. Well, naturally, no one has ever believed that's what he was saying, right? And no one listened to him. And very quickly after the Sermon on the Mount, he quit telling people what he actually believed and knew, and then just talked in parables the rest of the way. Because it doesn't work. You can't tell.
Wow. Holy shit. You're saying, oh, wow, that is amazing. That was his first... That was like the beta test for Christianity, and he realized, this doesn't work. They don't hear it at all. You got to talk to them in stories. That's when he started saying, "Let them who have ears to listen hear," because he realized, "Shit, this is their." Wow, that is so intensely beautiful.
I just love the fact of thinking about him wandering around and just kind of, I just picture him as kind of a guy who's just walking down streets. He goes down the rich people's streets. He sees how they act behind their walls and their protectiveness and their separateness and their caginess. And then if you walk down, I don't know about you, but I make a point when I'm in a city of walking down into crummy neighborhoods, because I've learned that what I was told to be suspicious of, I was wrong about. I was told to be suspicious of people coming up to you and talking to you, right? Of course, be suspicious of the drug dealers on the corner. You know, I'm not saying don't be suspicious of the people who are actually up to something. But the people who are coming up to you and talking to you, that's just how you behave in a poor neighborhood. You go up to people and you say, hey, what's happening? What you doing here? And they're really curious. Here I am, this guy who looks this bourgeois way. They're curious. Why are you here? And so, and if you talk to them, the nice thing about talking to people who are poor in spirit is they'll actually answer you truthfully. You ask, how are you doing? And they'll go, you know, my feet are really hurting today. And they're not scared of their own suffering or of talking about it or of me relating to it. And they assume that I'm like them. And I'm capable of absorbing their suffering in the sense of, hey, tell me more.
Yeah.
And that's in the end, by the way, that's the Jesus way of compassion, is just tell me more. Tell me more. I'm not here to fix it. I'm not here. It's nice that there are food pantries and important and all of that. And that's one way of feeling compassionate. But true compassion is basically getting in someone's face who's suffering and saying, tell me about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because we complain, we vent, we talk about our suffering because it's the best way to get rid of it.
Well, yeah. And you know, that is so beautiful. And if I could just add one piece, it's also believing them. There's a culture of not believing people when they say they're suffering, or imagine they're putting on a show or something like that. That, you know, or that their suffering isn't justified. Right. And that is that's so brutal to do to people. If you just, and also a lot of people, I think, have resentment for people in their lives who they consider to be whiny or whatever, weak, or all this Machiavellian, a Machiavellian attitude towards people. But if we go back a few minutes to what you were talking about earlier, which is, what was the quote? Tom Robbins or not Tom?
Oh,
Robbins.
Vonnegut. Nice, nice, very nice. So many people in the same device.
That. When you start there and realize that, maybe you're, you know, wherever you're at can't understand why they're suffering, or that doesn't seem like something that would make you suffer. But when you just realize, no, they're really fucking suffering. Yeah. They're not lying about it. That's real. For me, that's the avenue to compassion, is to trust when someone says they're not happy, they mean it. The logic behind it, who cares? They don't feel good. And that's real. And then I can listen and do what Jesus was, I think, advising. What is the kingdom of heaven?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's ease, going with the flow, being able to be fascinated by what is right around me. And I think that most of love is the same as most of truth, which is fascination with the other. And I can't imagine that if you use the metaphor of God having created us, or created the world and created us, I can't imagine that the God who created us as self-reflective so that it could know itself would want us to be focused on being productive for each other more than would want us to be fascinated in the world that the God had created.
Oh, yeah. Whoa. Well, what happened, though? I mean, you know, I'm not asking you to give me an explanation for why there's evil in the world, but what did happen? I mean, if we're going to do the theistic thing and we're going to go down that route,
We live next door to strangers. It's just we have not learned how to live next door to strangers. And it's just it's a kind of weird problem. It as far as I know, it hasn't happened to any other species where we had a way of living out of our instincts with a modest amount of self-reflection that didn't have to turn into a whole lot of social restraint when we lived in Stone Age tribes. And there are Stone Age tribes that are still around in New Guinea and the Amazon, a couple other places. And the anthropologists who kind of study them point out that they, if you're in a closed tribe where the enemy is a known other tribe, the other side of a boundary that only enters in your life on very rare occasions or in a very patterned and defined way, and you haven't been in battle with that tribe for years, or maybe you have, I suppose it wouldn't make much difference. When you're around your own people in your tribe, you have perfect trust.
Yes.
And you live your life in perfect trust, right? There isn't a hierarchy of property. There isn't a hierarchy of jobs. There aren't hierarchies. There's division of labor, no question. But everybody's kind of in the same... They're equal in the sense that you come up with tribal decisions by consensus. You don't even have votes in these kind of tribes. An outsider has a hard time understanding how the tribe made a decision to move from here to there, even though they had a tribal council. The consensus of people who trust each other is very different from the combative, competitive kind of way that we behave. There was a point at which the earth got too populated and tribes had to merge. And without learning how to treat each other the way that they had treated themselves while in the tribes. And so then you have to have justice systems and you have private property and you have all this kind of crap we have. But my main problem is as a civilized human being is that I have lots and lots of very nice neighbors, and I know my neighbors, and all my neighbors have fences.
Right? My
neighbors have fences. I'm fucked. As soon as my neighbor has a fence, I'm fucked, right? Because I am no longer trusting. I'm living in a world where my default is distrust, not trust.
It gets crazy at that point. I can't get out of it. We just moved into a neighborhood, and our neighbor came walking into our yard to say hello. And I got to tell you that the part of me that is not the kingdom of heaven, the reaction internally I had was so embarrassing and ape-like as I'm thinking, like, what? You can't just walk into my yard, man. You don't know me. Why are you walking into my yard? And it's an embarrassment because I don't want to be like that. But then also, I don't know him. Who is he? I don't know this guy's history or story or, who knows? What are his intentions? I mean, don't you think there is something to be said for boundaryism and fences and, because we got these loons out there. We got loons.
The problem with taking that view, and I take that view like anybody would, is that we've taken it so far that we've trained our guardians, our police forces, to actually spend their time in an exercise of looking for suspicious-looking people.
Right.
It turns out that's a bad exercise.
Yes.
Right? You train. What would be important would be for us to learn how not to look at people as suspicious, right? Because, of course, they're going to be the bad actors, but they're fairly anomalous. So that if you go into a bad neighborhood or go into a store or anywhere, if you go in without looking for suspicious people, without picking people out, you're probably pretty safe. You're probably, we do have a decent civilization and a decent set of rules that behaves kind of like we can trust each other and has replacements for natural trust. And we could actually live through them, but we haven't figured out that we can and that we can today and that we have to, for instance, I mean, Black Lives Matter is so important, but it's so focused on deaths and not on, wait a minute, our cops are trained to look for suspicious people. Let's get them to quit doing that. We'll lose a modest amount of control over crime, but what we will gain will far surpass that and will remove crime in the long run. But anyway, I have a neighbor moved in a little after we moved in here, and my neighbor decided that he didn't like the redwood tree that I had planted because in 60 years it'll block his view. And so,
oh my God, how old is he?
Yeah, well, I tried to work with him on that, and I think we worked it out. And then he got furious when we had these power outages. And because I'm from the East Coast, I went and bought a generator. That's what you in the East Coast, you have blizzards and you have generators. And everybody, boy, when there's a blizzard, it is a racket, walking down the street because everybody's got their generator. Well, I happened to be the first person on the block to get the generator when PG&E started their blackouts. And so he didn't like the sound of the generator and the decibels were too loud. So he became, to me, the bad neighbor, right?
Right.
And then one day, I just started laughing at realizing, to him, I'm the bad neighbor. And he has no idea that, to me, he's the bad neighbor, right?
Wow.
That's how distrust is so silly. I mean, any normal, if we were smart about it, we would actually, instead of sending texts, and God, he got at me through next door at one point. And
there was
He went next door? Well, he kind of did. And then I came in and the whole thing is kind of funny. But if we were truly tribal and weren't living next door to strangers, none of that is possible.
Right.
None of that. You're all, there's such communal purpose when you're only needs are true needs, food, shelter. And the funny thing is, so we gossip complaining about our social lives, right? That's 80% of what we do is gossip as human beings, right?
Yeah.
Tribal people gossip too. You know what they gossip about? Yeah. Falling out of trees, getting eaten by large mammals. got a drought. Roots that you eat during the time of drought that are slightly toxic but will keep you alive, right?
Yeah.
So they gossip about their actual needs in the world to stay alive. We gossip about all this crap because we've got our actual needs largely taken care of. We move massive amounts of food around the world through our transportation systems. So drought for most of us isn't a possibility or a probability.
Yeah.
We have shelter and we have clothes and that's it. So most people think they have a bunch of needs. You have three needs: food, shelter, clothes. And by the way, you don't need them in the long run. You need them in the short run.
Right.
So living week to week, that's fine. You've got, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you've got food, shelter, and clothing dealt with for the week, right? That's fine.
Yes.
We think there's something wrong with both our belief that that's enough and our belief that there aren't other needs. And so we build up all these other needs and complain when they are difficult to maintain. So I don't know about you, but I'd say at least half my life is maintenance of the stuff beyond food, shelter, and clothing that
I
have collected around me, right? And I think that I'm getting enjoyment out of them when what I'm primarily doing is maintaining them. It's funny.
No, here's an ironic thing. One of the most challenging events in my marriage right now is trying to get a fucking fence built around our yard so that we can keep the dogs in. And getting a fence right now is really, like, I'm not going to go into it. By now, my listeners are like, I don't know how many listeners I've lost complaining about fencing, but this is like it's really hard during the pandemic to do this. But yes, and I, you know, I'm one of my dear friends is having a rough go right now, and part of what's bugging him is that he feels guilty about not being some profoundly tremendous success, not you know, the what you just said about the week to week thing. I think for a lot of people is really going to make them feel a little better, because so many people beat themselves up for being in that situation, but in not realizing that that's actually, that is, you can call that success. You're eating, you're sheltered, you have clothes.
I mean, you think about it, until what, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 99% of the world lived paycheck to paycheck, the equivalent, right? Nobody saved money, right? It wasn't an expectation. Yeah. There were some rich people and there were some politically powerful people, but most people just kind of lived their lives. Now, were they animals? No, they were self-reflective human beings with brains and interests, and they had a huge amount of leisure time, right? Yeah. And they used it, right? And we think everybody was a Puritan and spent 14 hours a day at work. That's absolutely not true, right? Sharecropping farmers in the Middle Ages worked several hours a day and lived in shacks and drank and hung out and talked and watched the sunrise and sunset and presumably went, holy cow, do you see that? Isn't that beautiful? Right?
Yeah.
And they didn't have fame and they didn't have money. And I'm not glorifying, so people are going to get on my ass and tell me that I'm somehow glorifying the poor and they have real, you know, there was poor public health and people only lived half as long as they do today and all of that kind of stuff. And all of that is also true.
Right. Now, I don't get that from you. I feel like what's coming out of you is more in along the lines of give yourself a break. Yeah. You're spending your entire life torturing yourself, tormenting yourself over these things that are so far away from authentic happiness. That's what I get from you. Not just these conversations, but our private chats too. Yeah. And it's such a liberating, way of looking at the world. And it's a great reminder for me, because I always get lost in the things that are so far away from just that. And you know, the what's scary about that is that if you're not careful, you'll just be dead. You know, you blink and you're dying, and you realize that the whole time you were doing some stupid, compulsive, masochistic, internalized capitalism dance. Your family was at home. Your loved ones were wondering where you were and then eventually forgetting about you. And that's pretty sad.
I mean, the weird part, it is sad, I guess, although I have another take on that, which is particularly if you have the good luck of getting a fatal diagnosis, you know, told you're going to die in a year, year and a half, rather than a sudden death, unexpected. But if it's not sudden and you have some warning about it, my experience is most people, virtually everybody.
Wait, did you say good luck? I'm sorry, did you say good luck?
So this is a great story, actually. Ram Dass wrote this for Yoga Journal many years ago. He got a phone call from Timothy Leary, and Timothy Leary says to Ram Dass, "Ram Dass, I have great news for you." And Ram Dass says, "What?" And he says, Timothy Leary says, "I'm going to die in a year and a half." And Ram Dass says, "How is that great news? You're my friend. You're my best friend. How's it great news that you're going to die?" And Timothy Leary says, "I know I'm going to die. That's what's a great news. I get to prepare for it."
Wow.
If you get a diagnosis that you have a disease that is incurable and you have a certain amount of time to live, the general, most people who go through that experience, who I've seen, very quickly adjust their thinking and very quickly let go of a huge number of unimportant things and very quickly bring their life together. And the interesting thing about the divine or consciousness with a big C or unifying with God or non-duality or any of these sorts of things is there's not much difference between spending 5 years in freedom and spending 20 minutes in freedom.
Wow.
If you've spent 20 minutes in freedom, and that's what dying people often do, is they get their 20 minutes of freedom, it's plenty.
Yeah.
It's plenty. Just knowing it, just having met it, it's plenty. And if you get more than that, it just becomes familiar and it's plenty too. Right?
Neil, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for your friendship. I hope that you and Annie and your next gossip session about me will forgive me. I don't do, I've never done heroin.
I don't believe you, and I want you to bring us some. Annie won't do it, but I turned it down when I was a teenager. It's one of the few regrets of my life.
No, I feel the same way about heroin that I feel about golf. I'm not doing it. I feel like I'll like, just grab
But Iggy, you know, Iggy Stooge is a big golfer.
Is he really?
That shook my world. I was like 25 when I found out that Iggy golfed, and I was like, how's that possible? He's Iggy.
Does he drill? What does he wear? Does he wear the outfit? Does he put on the khakis and the stupid Neil, thank you so much. Shapes of Truth, it's out now. This is a wonderful book. And you can find all the links to that at duncantrussell.com. But where can people find you if they want to connect with you, Neil?
Shapesoftruth.com. You can make your way into me that way. The book's available everywhere, online. Have fun with it. It's a good old woo-woo book.
It's fucking great. You will love it. It's a mind blower. And you can see that that's the case just from listening to this genius I got to talk with. Not just for this hour. Maybe I'll just keep saying I erase the podcast just to continue talking with you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, Neil.
Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you. That was Neil Allen, everybody. All the links you need to find Neil are going to be at shapesoftruth.com. If for some reason you can't remember that, it'll be at duncantrussell.com. Tremendous thank you to our sponsors for supporting the DTFH, and a big thank you to you for listening. This is a two-episode week. I know I promised you that last week, but this is actually that week. We'll be back in a few days with a conversation with Jason Louvre. See you then. Have a great week. Bye.